Al Nettleton is a longtime member of Prairie UU Society. He has held several offices in the congregation and has presented many programs in the past. His presentation today is Thomas Wentworth Higginson, Unitarian Minister and the Civil War. It relates to several UU principles, including number 1, 2, 4, 5, and 6.
I'd like to talk about why it is that I got interested in Higginson. Okay, why I got interested in Higginson. And that has to do with Wisconsin Public Radio, because the day after I retired, I got a chance for the first time to, in the middle of the day, actually answer the midday quiz. And my reward for being randomly picked as the winner that day was this book, which is Being a Pacifist and Applying for a Conscientious Objector Status. I've never been much of a war historian. And I thought, oh, okay, I'll give this a try. And I opened it up and found the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process, the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. What is there about that that doesn't apply to the Civil War and Higginson? I may. We want to look at the map and a couple of things that we need to talk about before going into Higginson. One is that as you find that Fort Sumter, in April of 1861, of course, there was something that happened at Fort Sumter. And I think most of us have learned over time that that was involved. Then on November 7th, at this area down here, on Hilton Head Island and on St. Philip's Island, there were two Civil War forts. And the Union Navy succeeded in a one-day war there in opening up this area. And all of these islands that are in the Georgia Sea Island area, the next day, didn't have any plantation owners. They had left and gone to the mainland. So, I assume some of the other islands that similar things happened. I have no idea of where the war and this particular Port Royal invasion succeeded in opening up for the Union additional territories. But then something happened shortly after that, and that is that I'm from the government and I'm here to help you happened. And something called the Port Royal Experiment was set up, and it operated from 1862 to 1865 in this island area. Then the next event was that Higginson was invited to come from Boston and landed on Port Royal Island, just south of Beaufort, which is up in this area, to take over as colonel of a black troop. So we're going to talk about some of the details on this. But before we do, I have to go back to talk about Higginson as a younger person. He was admitted to Yale when he was, not to Yale, to Harvard when he was 13. And he was a little over 6 feet tall and apparently was very awkward as a 13-year-old amongst some of the older students at Harvard. At age 16, which would have been 3 years later, he was Phi Beta Kappa. He worked for a while as a tutor for a rich relative. And then I'm going to tell other parts of the story in the meantime there. Went to Harvard Divinity School in 1847 and then was hired when he graduated by the First Religious Society of Newburyport, Massachusetts. But he was too controversial and was asked to resign by the board and the members in 1848. And then about 4 years passed before he had his next minister's job. He was at the Free Chest in Worcester. So I guess we have to describe him now as a Civil War time as an officer and a gentleman, don't we? And he landed during the experiment in the middle of a war. The regiment that he was taking over had about 1,000 black soldiers, and a second regiment was later added under his command, and additional blacks came across the lines or were captured in other activities. And meanwhile, in all of this area around the Buford Harbor, notice the circles here. This is the Port Royal experiment, and the number of miles, these circles are 5 mile ranges for the distance from Port Royal. And he was right in the middle of that at about this point for his encampment. But meanwhile, there were about 10,000 soldiers. Most of them were on Hilton Head. There was a regiment at Buford, and the blacks were isolated, other than, of course, white officers in the camp where he was commander. And under the experiment, of course, the schools were established, and Ann Pryor talked about the Penn Center and school that was established. It was one of several schools that were created mostly by missionaries from Philadelphia and, of course, new other parts of the North. And you notice the cotton here. For the first time, slaves were actually given income. And the income typically was somewhere in the neighborhood of $10 a month. The pay for 700 pounds, which I assume is the size of a large bale of cotton, was a dollar. These were the kinds of housing that were available for the blacks and the slaves at that time. And a map from that time, we have a little bit more detail here. Here is St. Helena Island, where the Penn School was. Thanks to Anne for this map. The Penn School, the Buford was here, and Port Royal, there was an encampment here, and Higginson's camp was about here. Hilton Head, again, I said, was about 4,000. This Fort Walker was one of the two forts that were captured by the Navy, Union Navy, to open up the ports. And of course, the black regiments did have a few photographs taken of them. These were the first South Carolina volunteers that the soldiers called the First South. And then when the next group was established, it was the Second South. And then, of course, an important thing happened on January 1st, and we had some reading, thank you, Eileen, for the Emancipation Proclamation. And that then gets into some of Higginson's style. He was egalitarian, highly educated, a naturalist, a diarist. He spent a lot of time writing about, in his diary, about the nature of the island that they were on, the tides, the mud flats, the birds, and also about the blacks that he was commanding. And he felt that they were much like children. And so there's a certain amount of historical racism in Higginson's work. But his instruction to the troops was that if you're well trained and you march correctly and you follow orders, that you'll be good soldiers. And he did treat them as humans and as individuals and as men. On the other hand, the soldiers had a strong distrust of the whites, especially in officers. And they were nervous about serving under this guy from New England. But the writing seemed to indicate that most of that was worked out, especially when he did find individuals in of the troops to give promotions to and to work as his bookkeepers and records writers and keepers. And so when the Emancipation Proclamation was signed, the first readings, many of them were in the South to as many blacks as they could get to, and Port Royal was an ideal place to do this reading, and Ann Pryor, in her program, talked about that. And in his writings, he was very proud of the soldiers. He had ordered and instructed them to march eyes ahead and not pay any attention to the crowds. There were some jeers, but his emphasis was that if we are successful, if we can work well, then we will have pride for blacks. On Port Royal, there's the monument to the Emancipation Proclamation. Thanks again to Anne for this picture, and a park where the fort was, where Higginson had it. And at the same time, Jefferson Davis issued orders that said any white officer of blacks will be hung if we catch them. And the same thing was said about the blacks who were serving, that if we catch any of them, they will be hung. But they were now officially recognized as Union soldiers. And of course, one of the jobs of a soldier in a war is to fight. And so he succeeded in getting permission from the general to do several outings, and two are the most important, and the book is about these two. We're going down south to Florida here. This line is showing the St. Mary's River. That's the border between Georgia and Florida. And at the mouth of the St. Mary's River is a town, Fernandina. Eileen and I spent time at a bed and breakfast there, and I didn't pay any attention to the fact that it was a Civil War site when we were there. We enjoyed the beach and the nature. So his first of these two excursions was to go up the St. Mary's as far as Woodstock is concerned. The reports were that there were many blacks that wanted to, slaves that wanted to come over to the Union side. And remember, on the other hand, that the publicity in the South was, A, those Union guys, if you're a slave and you think you're going to get better off going over to them, think about it, they et cetera. And so up the St. Mary's, and word was that it were lumber mills up there that had lots of pine that had been cut. And by the way, in the camp, all of the soldiers had wood floors in their tents. So they went up to St. Mary's, and the intelligence said that you could probably make it up without being attacked, but in previous excursions, going downriver was the dangerous part of this process. So going upriver on a converted New York ferry boat, double-ended, they went aground seven times in the night trying to get up to Woodstock. And when they did get there, they basically found out that bricks were more plentiful than lumber, and so they had to take bricks back because the officers in Fernandina said, hey, there are bricks up there, and we want those bricks to build fortifications, so why don't you bring those back instead of lumber? When they got to Woodstock, there was a woman living there still who had been a slave owner, and Higginson discovered the slave discipline house and the stocks that were there And one of the spoils of war is that you can take things during the Civil War if they are being used for war purposes. And he interpreted the stocks that were holding the blacks and the slaves as being war purposes, and he's confiscated those and took them back to his general recognition of the rivals. They were, of course, attacked several times on the way down, and all I could think of is, thank goodness that they didn't have the AR rifles in those days and the automated. The ferry was hit multiple times. The captain of the ferry was killed on the way down, and they didn't have pilots, but they did succeed in making it downriver and back up to Port Royal. The second excursion that the book is about is down here to Jacksonville. So if you come down south and in here is Jacksonville. And they got permission to try and take Jacksonville from the rebels and make it a Union territory again. The goal of the general that Higginson worked for was to get all of Florida back into the Union and cut off the Confederacy from the resources of Florida. And so they succeeded in taking Jacksonville, held it for 3 weeks until there was an order to return, and it was never explained as to why it is that we have to go back north and leave Jacksonville, but they did. During that process, on up the St. John's River, more than 50 miles on excursions, and one of the major events was a volunteer who had been a slave who knew about a bridge that he could burn, and he was unsuccessful, but he did return from that excursion. And I want to show this as the interaction with the Penn School, because Charlotte Fortin was one of the teachers at the school. She was from Massachusetts, a black who had been trained well as a teacher and was one of the teachers at the Penn School. And Towne did agree to let her go to Fernandina to be a teacher as part of an expansion of the Port Royal experiment. She did go with the troops on, they had six boats taking them to Florida when they did the invasion into Jacksonville. And she was on one of those ships and was left in Fernandina. But as the order for withdrawal was given, she did go back and reestablished herself as a teacher at Penn School. Let's go back now and talk about Higginson, the non-Civil War Higginson, and most of the rest of what we're going to talk about is the non-Civil War part of him. He was an abolitionist. He was a very active women's rights advocate. He was a minister, of course, an author. He wrote over 25 books. 52 books was the number. I have to invert those numbers. Obviously a lecturer on the Lycian circuit. And in 1847, before the Civil War, he married a distant cousin, Mary Channing, who was the sister of Ellery Channing. And they then moved from Boston to Newburyport, Rhode Island. She had very severe arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis. And they did go to the Azores, attempting to see if warmer weather would work before the Civil War, but did return, and then to Newburyport. She died in 1877, and was in longtime poor health, and so was left behind while he was in the Civil War. They did raise a niece, Ellen Channing, who was Margaret Fuller's sister. And of course, his second wife was Mary Thatcher, who was one of the many authors that he mentored. And they married in 1889 and had two children. One of them lived, one of the girls lived to be into adulthood. And back when he was at Harvard in the ministry, he dropped out during that process so that he could go and support Theodore Parker in his anti-Mexican war activities of trying to stop any possible war with Mexico, because it would probably increase the number of slaves, slave states in the United States. He also was involved in the issues of Kansas and Nebraska. The states that were added got to choose whether they would be slave states or not, and so he spent time on that. He was a gun runner in Kansas. He got to know, he wrote about Nat Turner, and then in 1848 he ran for Congress. He didn't win. He was on the Free Soil ticket. He ran again in 1850, also didn't win. So parallel with his time in Boston, he was a very active transcendentalist with Theodore Parker and others. He formed the Worcester Disunion Convention in 1857. They were supporting William Lloyd Garrison's ideas, Wendell Ferris, Phillips, Charles Sumner, and they felt if slavery couldn't be eliminated in the North, that they had to end any association with the South and any constitution that endorsed slavery. I'm going to go back, excuse me. And then in 1854, he in Boston was one who invaded the federal courthouse with a battering ram, trying to break in and free a fugitive slave from the South, who they weren't successful, but there was a trial of those that were involved. And Higginson did get a sword injury to his chin, which was one of the reasons, I think, that he wore his beard and mustache. And so he then worked on with the Boston Vigilance Committee. And here are some of the members of the Vigilance Committee. And I've marked William Henry Channing, William Lloyd Garrison, Higginson, of course, Samuel G'day Howell, and others that I can't read from here, that were involved in this vigilance committee. And out of those, at least three members, along with three other people, formed a group called the Secret Six. Theodore Parker and Samuel G'day Howell, who, by the way, was the husband of Julia Ward Howell, were involved in that. And here are the six. And what they did was to raise money to support John Brown. John Brown had been in Kansas. Higginson had gotten to know him and was helping to supply guns to that. They raised $500 to help John Brown do his Harper's Ferry activity. And of course, that was not successful. And John Brown's body is a song that's related to that. And we'll talk a little bit more about why that's one of the things that we're going to be singing today. And then he was in the Massachusetts Infantry as a captain and invited to the command of the First South by one of his Harvard's classmates. So he didn't seek it, but he was happy to take it. So remember this guy. He was somewhat of a war hero, but he was wounded in the Civil War and he needed to resign from the military. He was highly educated coming back. He had a family. He had been too liberal for his Unitarian congregations, so he needed to go. So one of the questions would be, would he be a good applicant if we had a vacancy here at Prairie? And so he helped form the Free Religious Association and was vice president of that. He wrote a book called The Young Folks' History of the United States, which was a very popular textbook, and later an adult version of that, A Larger History of the United States. And the image he worked on, of course, was this, you know, I was in the South as an intellectual, and I helped the blacks. But you have to remember that he was an anthropologist. He collected the slave songs, included that as one of the chapters in a book he published in 1870, with articles before that of each of the chapters in the Atlantic Monthly. And so he did, of course, age a bit, but let me name drop a little bit more here. Clara Barton and Harriet Tubman were part of the people that he knew in Port Royal, in that area. Tubman was a nurse, and Clara Barton was in the hospital for the Union soldiers. Henry David Thoreau, Wendell Phillips, William Lord Garrison, Lucy Stone and her husband Harry Brown Blackwell, Jack London, Clarence Darrow, Upton Sinclair were all friends of his. And here I felt that we couldn't avoid showing this picture. I'm not certain whether this is the niece that he was raising or a daughter, because I couldn't find a time period for that. It's a three-wheel bicycle. And of course, then in later life, he was a member of the Massachusetts House of Representatives. He was a Massachusetts State Board of Education member. He was chief of staff for the governor of Massachusetts. Formed Literary Life magazine. In the Literary Life magazine, there was a poll published, and he was fourth in prominence as living American, behind Edison, Twain, and Carnegie. So a quest for justice and human rights is really important. This is a book that I want to read next, I think. It's called White Heat, and it's all about his friendship and mentoring of Emily Dickinson. He and a woman were the editors of Dickinson's poetry after her death. The other woman had edited the material substantially before Higginson saw it. He didn't know that, and he was criticized greatly for the damage that he did to Dickinson's poetry. But that is one of the next things. And so I want to do a few quotes here. It's no discredit to Walt Whitman that he wrote Leaves of Grass, only that he did not burn it afterwards. When a thought takes one's breath away, a grammar lesson seems an impertinence. There is no defense against adverse fortune which is so effectual as an habitual sense of humor. And I did learn that about him as I was reading it. I did read his History of the Black Soldiers. I strongly recommend the Gutenberg Project. You can get PDFs of most of Higginson's writings. He died May 9th, 1911, a little less than a month after my mother was born, for context. And one of the things in his writing is that he talked about the marching of the soldiers and their singing. And one of the things that constantly was being sung was John Brown's song, which Julia Ward Howe rewrote to be the Battle Hymn of the Republic, but John Brown's body was just a rewrite of a camp meeting religious song called Say Brothers, Will You Meet Us? And Ron Fry, I call on to lead us in singing John Brown's body.
Our closing words are by Thomas Wentworth Higginson, and they will be read by Al Nettleton.
Before getting to Higginson's final words from our order of service, I'd like to remind you that the Republicans were the Unionists, the Democrats were the Confederates, basically, in our world at that time. And so attacking the courthouse was... Higginson, a Proud Boy, or was he an Antifa member? So our final words today. Our true religious life begins when we discover that there is an inner light, not infallible, but invaluable, which lighteth every man that cometh unto the world. Then we have something to steer by, and it is chiefly this, and not an anchor, that we need. The human soul, like any other noble vessel, was not built to be anchored, but to sail.